The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Kevin Richard.
Welcome to the City Club's 24th annual Legislative Pundits Forum. My name is Kevin Richard. I'm a reporter with Idaho Education News. I am Boise's reigning tallest moderator. That's why they bring me back. I'm the tallest moderator in town. And I'm also a pseudo-pundit. But don't worry, we've got actual real, live, legitimate pundits here today, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. I would like to thank a few of our partners who help make these events possible. Today's forum sponsors are ACLU of Idaho, the Idaho Conservation League, Idaho State University, Micron Technology, and Strategies 360. Our media partners are Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI Radio, the Idaho Statesman, and Pepper Shock Media. We have a terrific panel here this afternoon, so let me introduce them. To my immediate right is Bill Spence, who covers politics and legislature for the Lewiston Tribune. He is one of our best and most experienced political writers, and I think it is safe to say that he is the best political writer that you can't find on Twitter. So I hope that in addition to using that hashtag CCPOI, that we also can trend the hashtag Spence on Twitter 2019. Let's get that trending. I would do it myself, but, I got this forum I have to moderate, so you're going to have to help me out there. Melissa Davlin is the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. She's also blogging on the complexities of the healthcare system and healthcare policy. Betsy Russell is the author of the indispensable Eye on Boise blog. Now, you might have heard this, but Betsy has changed jobs since our last forum a year ago. She now writes for the Idaho Press, and what that really means is that she has a whole new group of legislators who can be called her legislators. So really, her career move has changed the very landscape of Idaho politics. Last but not least is Stephanie Witt, who is a professor of public policy and administration at Boise State University. Okay, one final introduction. Backed by basically no popular demand whatsoever is our old friend the Snark Jar. Now, you know the drill here. If there's a quip that crosses that murky line into snark, it's going to cost somebody. So let's jump into business here. We had news today at the Idaho Supreme Court. We had a long-awaited hearing on the lawsuit over Proposition 2 Medicaid expansion. Melissa, Betsy, I know you both were there. Why don't you start by just giving us the recap of what you heard?
I thought the arguments were absolutely fascinating today, and we learned quite a bit during the course of those arguments. One of the big things was that there have been significant procedural issues that have been raised in this case. Did Brent Regan, the board chairman of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, actually have standing to sue? Does the Idaho Supreme Court have jurisdiction to hear this case? Was it even properly brought? And there were all kinds of arguments on both sides, for and against all these procedural arguments. And the justices, I thought, made it pretty clear that that's not really where they're going. They're not inclined to just throw this thing out on procedural arguments and not answer the question. I think it was Chief Justice Roger Burdick who said, the legislature's waiting, the people are waiting to find out, is this law constitutional or not? If we throw it out on procedural grounds, where's the remedy? Where's the answer? So I think we got some pretty strong hints there that they want to look at the merits of the case, even if there were procedural reasons to throw it out. So then when it comes to the merits of the case, boy, really lively arguments, engaged justices, tons of pointed questions. And the heart of the case, saying that that Proposition 2, the Medicaid expansion initiative, is unconstitutional, rests on what's called the non-delegation argument. The idea that this initiative is delegating state lawmaking authority to the federal government and to the executive branch of the state government. And some of the justices' questions extended the logic behind this lawsuit to other areas. So, for example, if this is delegating legislative authority because it cites federal poverty levels or federal eligibility levels, then what about the state law that ties Idaho's minimum wage to the federal minimum wage? Is that unconstitutional, too? What about our entire Medicaid system, which also relies on federal eligibility rules? Basically, we saw some logical extensions of this argument that led to some fairly absurd places. And so, to me, that was a hint as to which way it's going to go.
Now, and this is something that came up in some of my earlier reporting. You know, the lawsuit is very specific about Proposition 2, but there are a number of Idaho statutes that are tied to federal laws and conform automatically. Federal minimum wage is one. A lot of the federal conformity the Idaho legislature votes on every year, so say EPA standards, right, or child support came up several years ago. The difference here is that it's automatic. The Idaho legislature wouldn't vote on it. And so Brian Kane, who is arguing on behalf of the Secretary of State, pointed out that the state fought for the right to opt in or out of Medicaid expansion in the first place. Idaho voters chose to opt in, and part of opting in is tying Idaho statute to that federal conformity. This is something that Idaho voters opted in. There's also nothing saying that Idaho couldn't opt back out if the federal government were to, say, change the way federal poverty is calculated. If the federal government were to change the cost sharing from the 90-10 that this was kind of sold on in the first place. But I'd agree with Betsy that I don't think that the justices bought the argument that there were no grounds to sue in the first place. That the justices were kind of asking, you know, you could either look at this as you sued too early or too late, depending on the arguments. You know, this you could have sued when this was an initiative. You could have sued once the federal government changed its standards. But you're suing now, and let's consider the merits of the case right now.
And I guess I would jump back in and say I'm not sure that they don't buy the arguments that there might be something wrong with the grounds to sue, but there's a different argument that there are reasons for them to take something up if it's such a big, important, compelling, pressing issue that it needs to be decided. And that's where I thought they were leaning.
The other question I saw online, it came up a lot today, was when's the court going to decide? You know, we're on a timeline. The state has to submit its plan in the next 3 weeks. The court isn't bound by any timeline. You know, they have a history of if there is a pressing issue that affects the state and the legislature, that they will issue something quickly, but they don't necessarily have to do that. So we might not see a decision until after the Department of Health and Welfare has already submitted their plan on Medicaid expansion to the feds. So we're just going to have to wait and see now.
Bill. Kevin, I was not at today's hearing, but I think it's important to point out that in Idaho, a Supreme Court opinion is just an opinion. So it's well known that there are more constitutional scholars in the Idaho legislature than any other legislative body in the country. So don't expect
We've heard mention of the Supreme Court in one legislator's head.
One of the things Brian Kane said today in arguments was, hey, there are already a number of unconstitutional laws on Idaho's books already. He just straight up said it. And by the way, I'm kind of glad that Bill wasn't there, because I worry that whenever there's an event that draws all the reporters out of the state house, then lawmakers are going to pick that time to finally secede from the union. Like, this is it. The reporters are gone. This is our chance. That is not snark. That's just truth.
There were also a couple of things that did not come up in today's arguments, but that were in the briefs, and I was waiting anxiously on the edge of my seat, but we did not hear the arguments to the justices about zombie legislators, right? That was an argument made in the briefs.
And we don't have zombie donuts here. I mean, what's the, you know?
Nor did we hear that $1 million lottery winners might qualify for Medicaid expansion.
So, I mean, to some degree, this feels like the waiting on Medicaid session. And Stephanie, I want to start with you here, because it's not just the legislature that is waiting on the outcome of this. I mean, local governments have a large stake in the decision when that decision comes. So, you know, take it from the local government perspective a little bit.
Well, that's right. The counties have responsibility for indigent health care. So if we can solve the problem of so many tens of thousands of people being without health care coverage, you're going to lessen the impact of those medical costs on the county indigent care funds. And, of course, they share that cost with the state. There is a state fund to help spread the cost around. In a small rural county, you know, if two families get cancer and they don't have health insurance, you're going to break the budget, right? So we spread those costs around. Presumably taking, what is the number, 80,000, 75 to 93,000 people I just heard earlier, you know, off of the indigent care rolls would help. Yeah. But generally, I mean, you know, we tried to wait out Obamacare for 8 years, right? And now it kind of feels like we might try to wait out Medicaid expansion for another year or two, kick it down the road.
Melissa.
I think when we talk about the other effects besides what happens for those individual patients who now will qualify for Medicaid starting in 2020, there are a number of other pieces of this puzzle that Proposition 2 didn't address, and that, you know, some of it's up, a lot of it's up to the legislature, and some of it's up to these rural hospitals, but we still have issues that there are a number of doctors and dentists who either don't accept Medicaid or have a cap on the number of Medicaid patients that they accept. We still have a doctor shortage problem, particularly in rural areas. We still have a cost issue. And those are all complex and probably couldn't, I don't want to hijack the entire forum to talk about these medical cost issues, but I will.
No, you won't.
No, I won't. Okay. But the fact of the matter is, there are still so many different issues related to healthcare. Proposition 2 is just one tiny piece of that puzzle, and we still don't know how much it's going to cost ultimately. Medicaid expansion, the estimates through the Milliman report were based on historically low unemployment rates in Idaho. The nature of unemployment rates in the economy is that they fluctuate, and that's going to change. And so it's likely that this is going to be a lot more expensive than the state initially thought, than voters initially knew.
Well, that's it. While that may be, we do know how much it would cost in the coming year based on the governor's budget recommendation. And what he has proposed, what Governor Brad Little has proposed, is that for basically the first 6 months of Medicaid expansion, since it wouldn't take effect until January 1 of 2020, that we would tap the Millennium Fund and we would tap savings to state programs that currently incur expenses to the general fund that they wouldn't have to anymore because the people they were serving through, say, behavioral health programs or something like that would then qualify for Medicaid. And the result would be no impact on the general fund in that first year. I think that's interesting. I think beyond the healthcare issues and the dollars and cents, this is really very much a political issue. And I think we heard this in the arguments at the Supreme Court today, the ideological and political underpinnings of some of the attitudes on both sides of this. There was a point at which Justice Mueller asked Brian Smith, the attorney for the Freedom Foundation, is it possible for our state to work with our federal government without surrendering our sovereignty? And Brian Smith said yes. But only if we can, you know, pick and choose which laws we want to comply with and not just have to accept them by default. And Justice Mueller said, isn't that what the people of this state did by passing Proposition 2?
So let's stay with Medicaid a little bit and maybe talk in the context of how it is affecting the flow of the legislative session the first 3 weeks in. Because you mentioned that the governor's budget does not contemplate using general fund dollars for Medicaid expansion, and that would allow the budgeting process to begin separate of whatever happens with the Medicaid expansion lawsuit. But this still feels like a waiting on the Supreme Court kind of legislative session. To what degree is that casting a shadow of what's going on so far?
Anybody? Oh, geez. well, my sense is that there's, like, everyone's holding their breath because they don't know what to make of the eventuality of the Medicaid decision. And further, the changes in the federal tax law have thrown our estimates about how much money we're going to have into a gray area, right? It appears we're running very far behind the estimates, but maybe we're going to make it all up at the end because nobody knows really what their tax – I don't know. I haven't done my taxes yet. Did any of you do that yet? But, you know, you don't know if you're going to pay or you're going to get back or if it's going to change. And so this isn't a group that likes to rush headlong into spending a lot of stuff, right? So they're gonna wait until they have some of these unknowns tagged down a little bit. But I mean, at least tax season is gonna post date when the legislature usually likes to get out of here. So I don't know how we balance that.
I will note that there was a federal court ruling that the entire Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional, and this came down about a month and a half ago. HHS Director Seema Verma directed states to keep operating as if this ruling didn't exist because that's not the final say. I imagine that the directive to Idaho would be the same. I mean, the Department of Health and Welfare is going ahead as if this lawsuit doesn't exist. They still have to submit their plan to the federal government. They're still working on that plan. But the legislature is a different beast. And whether or not that's going to stall conversations either on funding or on potential sideboards like a work requirement or a job training requirement, we'll see, but I'm hearing lawmakers already begin to talk. So it's not like nothing is happening. It's not like people are stalled completely and not discussing this. That's not the case.
Kevin, I think clearly the first few weeks of the legislative session have been kind of a methodical pace. I mean, as of last Friday, 80 bills had been introduced. The five-year average is closer to about 105 bills. But my impression is that methodical attitude has to do with a broad range of issues, not specifically Medicaid expansion. I mean, that's one issue you've got the legislature has to deal with. The question that Stephanie addressed of what's going to happen with the CAT fund and county medical indigency payments. But then you've got the public school funding formula issue that people are trying to get up to speed on. You've got other budget issues. You've got the question of prison expansions and sentencing reform. There are a lot of major issues on their plate this year, and I think all of those are contributing to a delay. I actually think the governor helped ease some of the concerns about Medicaid expansion with his budget proposal that basically said, okay, for the first year, there's no general fund impact. So take that off the table.
So audience question on Medicaid, and I want to get to it before we maybe move to other topics. What is the likelihood that the legislature simply overrides the will of the voters on Prop 2?
Boy,
likely,
I don't
unlikely,
think so.
Not very likely at all.
I don't see them doing that. Now, there is precedent. The legislature overturned the term limits initiative, and that was extremely unpopular. But this passed with 61%. We have a governor saying he's committed to carrying out the will of the people. I don't see them overturning it. However, Melissa mentioned sideboards, and there are lots of discussions going on over at the State House right now about what could they do to add sideboards, basically for the legislators to put their fingerprints on this law that the voters have gone out there and passed on their own. And there's a lot of sentiment to do that, but some of the things that are being considered are just plain unworkable. The idea of a work requirement, we found out early this session, would be incredibly expensive. The state would have to pay the full cost. Feds wouldn't match it. But there are other things, and there are ideas being tossed around all over the place, and I would not be at all surprised to see some of those come forward.
It's also worth noting that in other states, work requirements have ended up in court. Most recently, Arizona ruled that tribal members were exempt from any work requirements, and that was a discussion that cost a lot of money and added a lot of confusion to the discussion.
So let me shift gears a little bit, and it kind of dovetails to Bill's remarks before about the governor. I do want to kind of open up a line of questioning. Look, we've all written the 100 days stories about a president or a governor, and they're kind of contrived. So it's even more contrived to ask about how a governor is doing 20-some days into a first term. But let's talk a little bit about the tone so far from the new governor and how that is affecting what we're seeing and hearing so far at the State House.
I've had the pleasure of listening to a lot of State of the State addresses with Melissa on Idaho Reports, and I thought the tone of this new governor in his speech was so much more conciliatory towards the other party and towards the federal government. There was not a lot of bombastic, you know, we're not going to do these terrible things the feds want to do and so on. And maybe that's a reflection of the Trump presidency fitting better ideologically. I don't know. But I thought it was, you know, when the minority party response says, gosh, we loved what we heard, that's a real different feel to me than we heard for a long time with the Otter speeches. So I think, you know, tone-wise, I would say that's different. I also would say that, we didn't hear anything immediately resisted by the legislature. Sometimes my memory was that the Governor Otter came in with some ideas about highway funding right away, and it just, you know, hit a wall and fell dead. You know, this, I didn't hear that kind of resistance to the governor's ideas in this speech. So it sounds like a good start to me. You know, you've got some people coming together saying, yeah, those ideas sound good. Nobody went rogue right away off on to the right of the governor either. And so it looks promising to me.
It seems like the governor has taken a fairly cautious approach, I think, as he starts out his new administration. And, you know, we certainly see that in his budget. As the Budget Committee has started to go through budgets, they've been coming across all these requests from agencies, and there's this one sounds like something really important, and the governor didn't recommend funding it. And then there's this one that sounds, you know, like the thing that the legislators really like, and he didn't recommend funding that either. And he wrote his whole budget about caution because of the revenue picture, and saving up money to consider options like eliminating the grocery tax a year out. He was also cautious in his policy proposals, but he's just being Brad Little, you know? he's not hiding anything. When he's asked what he thinks, he says it. At the Idaho Environmental Forum, he was asked about climate change, and he talked about actually what he has observed on the ground on his ranch and how real climate change is to him. And a lot of people were shocked. In Idaho politics, we have a Republican, conservative governor talking about climate change. He's just telling it like it is.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that stood out to me was...
Do I have to put money in for that?
I mean, they're not going to say no. One of the things that stood out to me with the State of the State, and in subsequent things that I've heard the governor speak at, that there haven't honestly been a whole lot of specifics or new ideas. The biggest mentions in his State of the State built on existing programs, like doubling the literacy initiative money. That's not a new idea. That's something that Governor Otter had proposed. You know, raising teacher pay to $40,000 is something that's also been discussed. He mentioned things that are going to be popular in a lot of circles, like, you know, water infrastructure is important. But again, there weren't any specifics in that speech.
But Melissa, I was just going to interrupt you to say that he ran on the idea that this is, if you like what's happening, here's more, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like the continuity. So it makes a lot of sense to me to see, you know, a continuation of policies that started with the previous administration.
I thought that was Sherry Ibarra's campaign slogan, continuity. If you like what's happening, here's more.
Yeah.
But as far as like a strong vision and strong policy proposals, you know,
it really was.
You need a dog?
Apparently so. That really was her campaign slogan.
Okay. I'm just going to let the self-police here for a second.
You know, and I've seen that come up in other places. While he did say climate change is real, that's something I've heard from more and more Republicans over the past several years. He didn't say, and here's what we should do to address it. And that's what was missing. It was the same thing with, you know, when he talked to the Council on Indian Affairs. He said, you know, keeping our environment pristine is important to us, and addressing transportation is important to us. He never said, and here's what we're going to do. And so I think, you know, that's notable, because it's not just caution. It's very much playing it safe and not saying anything that's really going to raise a lot of eyebrows. Who in Idaho is going to say, you know what, now I think water infrastructure is pretty overrated. So, I, you know.
But talking about climate change, and this goes to a question from the audience, I mean, that was a fairly, you know, stark statement from the governor. Does it move the conversation in any way this session or beyond? Or was it just a talking point that maybe caught us a little bit by surprise?
You know, it conceivably could. He was followed right after his comments by House Speaker Scott Begke, who made it plain that he's not quite there yet, where the governor is, and, you know, he might be more likely to talk about cycles and so on. But I think it kind of lays the groundwork for future conversations. I think eventually it could make a difference.
Kevin, you talked about kind of the 20-odd day honeymoon. You know, where a spouse talks about big expenditures in the family and things are, you know, everybody kind of shakes their head and says fine, and then it's not until they actually come up with specifics that the claws come out. So no, nothing's going to come of climate change this session. And if it does, that's when the honeymoon's over.
I think it will move the conversation forward if he were to say something along the lines of, and yes, I believe that human activity contributes to climate change, or here's something that I think that we need to do about it. But when you have the governor agreeing with something that 99% of the scientific community has had a consensus on for years, that's an awfully little baby step.
Mm-hmm. For our radio audience, you're listening to the City Club of Boise's annual Legislative Political Pundits Forum, and I want to shift gears to a couple of questions about education, and I may take moderator's prerogative and chime in as we go on this. One of the hottest issues potentially this session is the debate over rewriting the school funding formula, and it is a hot debate even though it's really arcane. Believe me, it's very important. What do you see as the prospects of this kind of change occurring this legislative session?
If the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader in the Senate were not part of the group that was recommending this, I don't think anybody would seriously be thinking, we can get this done this session. The level of understanding by the legislature as a whole of what's entailed with the new funding formula isn't there. For any other past issue, this would be an educational session in the sense that let's start talking to the body about this big policy change. We're not intending to actually pass legislation this session. We just want to get people up to speed so that next year or the year after, then we can actually implement the policy change. That would be my expectation of what happens. It's going to be interesting when you've got leadership kind of putting their thumb on the scale, whether that's going to be enough to get it over the hump.
I think there are a lot of fears and suspicions about the new funding formula, and part of that is because of what Bill talked about, and people not knowing much about it, but part of it is also because it's so changeable. It's basically a system in which you could put in all these different inputs, and certain inputs that they could put in would really hurt certain types of school districts and would really help others. And there are a sizable number of school superintendents who are extremely concerned that this is going to be used to damage their districts, their regions, and you know, if that's how it comes across, I don't know how it succeeds, and it certainly wouldn't, you know, if this is going to be our next Luna law or something. But I think there's still work to be done. Bill talked about it being an educational year, and then maybe you pass the legislation the next year. Speaker Scott Begke has talked about passing the legislation this year, but it wouldn't take effect for another year. But it's definitely been laid out as a process that they've got to bring everybody through. And it's not just a process of educating people about what it is. It's deciding what it's going to be, what those inputs are, how they come out, who they're going to help, who they're going to hurt.
Yeah. Well, a formula like this determines the winners and losers, if you will, right? So anytime, you know, you turn that rock over, all the bugs scatter. So you gotta figure out who's going to, you know, is this going to hurt me? Is it going to help me? Is it going to cause, think of the disruption of millions of dollars in change across districts as they learn, you know, to live with a new budgetary number. Now, my understanding is this formula can be so complex that, like, you know, at times we've only had a handful of people in the Department of Education who can sit down and tell you all about it, right? So there are a lot of moving parts, and it's hard to see if you change this one little thing, what's going to happen in the outcome, right? And it's all about the algorithm and the weighted values given to different things. most of us don't ever want to think about all those things. You know, I mean, that's just way too far in the weeds. But those are going to result in real financial changes to districts. So in this case, it will take time, I think, for everybody to get organized and then go see what little part of all that formula they care about and then press on it one way or the other. So I see it taking a lot of time.
On the flip side, you have Speaker Scott Bedke and Representative Wendy Horman really taking the lead and being champions of this funding formula. In a year where there are a number of new lawmakers who are looking to them for leadership, and arguably they're among the strongest voices in education leadership in Idaho, that might change the dynamic in a different way. So even if it's complicated, it might lead to more deferral to these, you know, legislative leaders in education.
To the point that I think that a couple of you made, I have not seen House Speaker Bedke as engaged on an issue personally that isn't a water bill, and I do not mean that to be snarky, and I know it sounds that way. It's very rare for a House Speaker to put himself on an interim committee, much less one that meets for three sessions, and when you go to these informational sessions with the education committees, I mean, it's Scott Bedke running the spreadsheet and playing with the numbers and running the numbers for legislators. I mean, his level of personal engagement, for good or ill, on this issue is marked, and I think it's noted by other legislators. But there is some really deep division within the school community about this, and I see one Boise trustee within my line of vision nodding. I mean, this is an issue that could very easily divide a lot of school leaders between now and the end of the session.
Let me jump in while you're looking for that. You know, a couple of people have mentioned deference, and certainly there is a level of deference in the Idaho legislature, but going back to your earlier question about the governor's honeymoon, you already had the revenue committee that did not accept or recommend the governor's revenue estimate for next year. The Millennium Fund Committee did not fully accept his recommendation for what should happen with the Millennium Fund. You had the CEC Committee that came up with a different recommendation for employee raises. None of those were major changes, but what they go to show is that the legislature takes its job of advice and consent seriously, and I think that's to their credit. I mean, this is not Congress rolling over in the face of a president. This is the Idaho legislature saying, okay, thanks, Governor, thanks, Speaker. We'll take your thoughts into consideration, but we're going to end up doing what we think is best.
Another education question kind of focuses on the budgets and the discrepancy between what State Superintendent Sherry Ibarra has asked for in her budget request and what Governor Little has laid out. A couple of the big differences here, the difference between what Superintendent Ibarra sought for school safety, a $19 million plan that would go into effect immediately, and the governor didn't fund that. Big difference in terms of early childhood learning and literacy. So the questioner asks, do Ibarra and Little talk? And how is she seen by the legislature? I'm not paying for this. This is a questioner asking a snarky question. This is an unfunded mandate if you expect me to pay for it. But the difference in the budgets between Ibarra and Little, and
I'm eyeing some governor staffers, trying to get them to nod yes or no slightly to see if they can tell me if they talk. But I think that gets to a bigger question as to where the vision for education in this state is coming from, and is it truly coming from Superintendent Ibarra at this point? You know, whether we're talking about school safety or the budget or literacy initiatives, that vision seems to be coming in some ways from either lawmakers or the governor's office at this point, especially when you see people not necessarily on board with the KISS school safety initiative, not recommending funding for it. And more conversations surrounding the governor's proposals as opposed to the superintendent's.
And really, Superintendent Ibarra, in her first four-year term, has not had much success pushing her agenda through the legislature. They really haven't bought on to many of her proposals, and her reaction typically has been to say, "That's great! What they did was just fine and wonderful." When the governor made his budget proposal and One of our Idaho Press reporters asked Superintendent Ibarra what she thought of his proposal for education. She said she was thrilled. Well, the governor proposed at that point a 5.9% increase, and she was calling for what, 6.8?
8.2.
That's right. I'm sorry. Depending on how you look at it, it was 8%. And so it was quite different. But she also made it extremely clear from the start she was willing to accept what he proposed as well. So that may be part of the reason why her agenda doesn't move.
Well, I think that looking for a unified vision on education is fruitless given the structures that we have. Okay, so we have in our state system, we elect the superintendent of instruction, public instruction, as a constitutional officer. She or he doesn't owe anything to the governor necessarily, and if this were a state with two parties, there might even be one from one party and one from another. And Weatherby loaned me $3 earlier. Yeah.
We take all major credit cards.
Yes. So we have an independently elected superintendent. We have the governor, who people look to as the policy leader. We have the legislature. But we also have the State Board of Education and the Department of Education. And there's a whole lot of motion. I'm just not sure there's any coherent direction, right? So each of those governing parts, the superintendent, the department, the state board, the governor, they all have a vision, but I'm not sure they're always the same.
Well, the one time that we have seen it all come together has been when, after the voters rejected the Luna laws and the governor formed a task force and he brought all of the stakeholders together, and we actually came up with a shared vision. Because you're right, there are a lot of different decision makers. And it was really only once there was a shared vision between, you know, the governor, the legislature, the superintendent, the teachers' union, the school boards, the school administrators, the PTA, everybody. When there was a shared vision, it actually advanced. And we didn't see fights every year in the Idaho legislature over the public school budget the way that we typically have in the past. So it may be that no matter who the superintendent was, no matter how strong they were at promoting their agenda, it couldn't really carry the day unless it was part of a shared vision with all those stakeholders.
And it's worth noting that the new governor wants to put together a task force of his own to look at education, and I think that's been the, you know, kind of the company line from the Little administration on a lot of education issues, from the school safety plan to mastery, is let's let this new task force have a chance to take a look at these issues before we get too far out on them.
Kevin, I also think as far as the apparent lack of communication from the budget perspective, I think it's important to point out that Superintendent Ibarra submitted her budget back in September, long before Governor Little submitted his request. So it's expected that there wouldn't have been complete agreement between those two budgets.
And in fairness, a long time before we started to see a lot of this uncertainty emerging about income tax returns and revenues coming in. I mean, that has changed the discussion of budgeting, not just about public education, this session. I mean, we've heard it in JFAC day after day, concern about laying out too much money on line items. Audience question here. Governor Little and Lieutenant Governor Little were a real team. How do you see Governor Little and new Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan working together?
Did you say Governor Little and Lieutenant Governor Little were a real team?
Governor Otter and Governor. Did I say that would be a team, all right?
You know. They were
no disagreement there, right? No. How do you see Governor Little and Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan working together or not working together?
Was that your question?
No.
Okay. There's another one you don't have.
No,
to
these
pay
are
for,
all. So. You know, these are all snarky audience questions.
Well, good question. It's no secret that there are some key policy differences between the two. Really, when it comes to the lieutenant governor's job, there's only one thing that he or she has to do, and that's run the Senate and also fill in for the governor when he's out of town. Everything else is kind of decided by the governor himself, you know. So whether or not he's going to send Lieutenant Governor McGeehan on, say, trade missions, like Cecil Andrus did for then-Lieutenant Governor Butch Otter, remains to be seen. But I also think that it's going to depend a lot on what Lieutenant Governor McGeehan decides she wants to do with this job. And that could take a year to sort out. You know, right now we're seeing her figure out how to run the Senate, and already in 3 weeks we've seen her improve pretty well. I mean, that's a big job, having to handle all of that parliamentary procedure and everything like that, and she's already it's going smoothly, I think, overall. But we're not going to see how well they work together, I think, for another year or so. It's going to be a process.
I think we should just wait and see if Little ever leaves the state in the next 4 years.
Actually,
there is a member of the governor's staff.
I'm trying to be diplomatic.
Lieutenant Governor McGeehan has already served as acting governor. I believe it was for only a couple of hours, but when Governor Little went up to North Idaho, he flew through Spokane, so she was acting governor.
I was going to ask, did he, like, make a run to Ontario or something? Only 2 hours.
It's a trade.
That
visit.
Was not a pot joke, by the way. It was not. I just realized how that came off. It was not.
This could be a potentially lucrative line of questioning here. For our radio audience, you're listening to the City Club of Boise's 24th annual Legislative Pundits Forum. We have about 20 minutes left and about 2.5 hours worth of good questions to go here, unfortunately. So we're going to try to hit as many of these as possible. A questioner wants to know about, and I'm going to massage the question a little bit because there is legislation on abortion that was introduced last week. Let's talk a little bit about that bill and its prospects, if any prospects at all.
Are we talking about the abortion complications bill?
Yes.
As I understand it, and I have not read the bill at length, I believe a third version of that was introduced today. There have been a couple different ones, and that is a bill amending a very extensive bill that passed last year, and that's being — was it last year or the year before? Anyway, it's being challenged in court. And so I think that what we're seeing there really is an attempt to adjust an existing law, perhaps to address some of those very legal issues that it's being challenged on, as opposed to a whole new debate about bringing in another new anti-abortion idea.
And we do have the nullification bill, though, too.
Oh, then there's that one as well, which has not been introduced yet. But this is a proposal from Representatives Heather Scott and John Green, a new representative from Post Falls.
Who in another year would have been two of your legislators, right?
And I work for the Idaho form. Press. But the bill proposes a combination of nullification and criminalizing abortion as murder, and it's kind of a unique putting together of two interesting ideas.
Listen, I think that the pro-life forces nationwide are revitalized by the prospect of a change in the balance on the U.S. Supreme Court. Political scientists like to talk about the scope of conflict, right? If you're losing in one arena, then you move the fight over here. So for most of the last 30-some years, we've had Roe versus Wade in place, and so all the real fighting has been at the state legislative level. Like, well, what if we make this kind of an agreement? Maybe you have to wait, or maybe you have to have this certain set of instructions, or maybe it has to be in a certain kind of clinic, or you can't teach it in a medical school. So all kinds of anti-abortion laws being tested in states around the country. And the result, I think, is largely that while the war of that may have been won with Roe versus Wade, was won with Roe versus Wade, the war was lost when access to those services has pretty much been eliminated in most states. So I think now we see even more enthusiasm to try to find, well, what kind of limits can we put around this that will just barely escape judicial scrutiny? And so we're going to see a lot of people running limitations on abortion kind of up the judicial flagpole to see which one of these will be a good test case to approach the ultimate precedent in Roe versus Wade. And that's all said. I'm not an attorney. That's just my feeling about the likelihood of these cases moving.
And I'll note, you know, back in 2016, where there were a lot of Republicans, especially in southern Idaho, who were feeling a lot of angst over whether or not they were going to vote for Donald Trump in the general election after his distasteful comments on sexual assault and everything came to light. Ultimately, a number of Republicans I spoke to said that while they didn't like how the president conducted himself, they wanted to vote for him because they felt like it was their best chance of ultimately someday overturning Roe v. Wade, you know, because they had their eyes on the courts. And so while the bill introduced by Representatives Green and Scott flat out said in the press release, not introduced yet, but the one that was sent around and is being circulated, they said in the press release that this isn't an attempt to challenge Roe v. Wade in the courts, that they're more focused on nullification. But as far as overturning Roe v. Wade eventually, that is something that is definitely on the table as far as a lot of lawmakers and politicians in Idaho are concerned.
Is there any chance of the legislature taking action on the faith healing loophole this year?
I think there's a chance. But I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a likelihood. I think there's a very strong push for the legislature to do exactly that. This issue has kind of gotten kind of bogged down the last time that the legislature tried to address this. The bill that actually came forward from Senator Dan Johnson of Lewiston basically dissatisfied everyone on all sides of the dispute. It did not remove the faith healing exemption. It changed some things one way, it changed some things the other, and everybody found a reason to hate it. And then once it was killed in the Senate, people said, oh, we can't take action on faith healing. I think that there's still very strong sentiment that there's something awry in our laws that needs to be fixed. And if the legislature can find its way to the right approach that doesn't just turn off all sides, something could pass, I think, maybe even this year.
And one thing that I see is a lot of confusion over what the loophole actually is. There's already a civil allowance for the state to step in and remove a child from a home as long as that child is still alive. But once the child has died, those parents cannot be prosecuted on the criminal side of things. And so it's something that when you explain it that way to people makes even less sense than how people generally understand the faith healing exemption to work, you know, right now. Because of the complexities of it and because it's so fraught with religion and religious freedom and child welfare, meanwhile, there are still children who are untreated in these communities. And these are not easy deaths. When you are dying from the flu, when you are dying from pneumonia, these are not peaceful, quiet deaths. I've read autopsy reports from children in this community, and a lot of them suffered. And this is still going on. And so I know it's on a lot of people's minds, but I haven't heard a lot of talk in the legislature this year about it.
I'll start with you on this one, Stephanie, because this is in your wheelhouse. Is the idea of making municipal races partisan, is it apt to go anywhere in this legislative session, or is it just the annual anti-Boise bill? No, somebody's worried, not mine. Stephanie.
Yeah. I personally think this is a terrible idea. I've long thought there's no Democrat or Republican way to build a road. There's just the best way, right? That it's not really about parties, political parties. So I'm a fan of keeping municipal races nonpartisan as part of the progressive heritage that we have in the states. We have an initiative, referendum, recall, at-large elections, a lot of things that went with those reforms. So I am personally not a fan of this. However, I will say that at least in Boise, you can sure see the overlay of candidates who are using to good effect the networking and mailing lists and so on of the parties. So Is it worth it if it's in name only? I don't know. But I personally believe that municipal affairs are more about trying to find the best quality of life and efficiency concerns and not so much about Republican versus Democrat. There are other things we have partisan that are dumb, too. The coroners, for example, the county coroners run on a party basis. And I've just, you know, always wanted to know, like, the difference, the Democrat autopsy versus the Republican autopsy and, you know.
I learned this the other day. Okay, so it was nonpartisan for a long time, but they made it partisan partly because in some places they weren't counting lynchings. They weren't documenting lynchings properly. So nationwide it became a partisan thing because it stemmed from racial divisions in the South.
With the recent measles outbreak in Washington, should there be a push in the legislature to support vaccination laws? And I know we have a bill that would seek to further weaken vaccination requirements. I mean,
I would be willing to bet that there's a reporter in the audience who submitted that question just because they want to see the kind of reaction they get in the legislature if that kind of bill were to be proposed.
You mean like my immediate reaction? Good luck with that.
Right. It's worth noting that on the same day that House Health and Welfare debated a rule change that would add a new requirement for high school seniors, they also made it much easier for parents to exempt their children from those vaccine requirements for both schools and daycares. Now you don't even have to fill out a form. You can write it on whatever piece of paper you have available. And that still drew concern from some people because it wasn't permissive enough and it would still give school districts, like, the parents' information. And so
to the point where, and I'll do a moderator's aside here, we have one of the highest opt-out rates on immunizations in the nation. I think we in Oregon are neck and neck for the highest rate. And the opt-out is so simple that I refuse, when I write about immunizations, and I do fairly regularly, I don't call it a requirement. It is so simple for parents to opt out that calling it a requirement, even though that's what the law says, it doesn't feel accurate to me.
I think that's fair.
We have a strong and growing anti-vaccine movement in Idaho. And as a result, we have very low immunization rates and very high opt-out rates. And we certainly are at risk for disease outbreak. And we have seen whooping cough outbreaks in the past. And this measles outbreak is really scary if it were to come to Idaho.
The opt-out rate in Boundary County, when I wrote about this a few months ago, was 29%. Mm-hmm. That's not even close to what the medical professionals will talk about herd immunity and getting to like 90-95%.
So you're not, Kevin, close. Maybe the way to ask that question is it going to take some sort of major outbreak with serious injuries or fatalities to get the legislature to tighten up those opt-out rules?
Well, that's what we would call a focusing event, right? That would get everybody's attention. Certainly don't want to wish for something like that, but to me this is one of those things. It just depends on how you frame it. If you frame the question of shall we interfere with parental choice about what happens to their kid, then of course we're not going to pass an immunization requirement. But if you frame it as this is a matter of public health and there are vulnerable populations who will die because somebody is freaky about an immunization, that's a different answer, right? And so far, what I've been hearing is the parental rights is overriding the public health issue.
And you say focus events. We've talked about this in other parts of Idaho policy for years. Is it going to take a bridge going out during rush hour to get more money for transportation? I think the same is true here. Is it going to take a really serious outbreak with potential fatalities to make this discussion that in Idaho, thank goodness, has thus far been hypothetical about a deadly outbreak and turn it into a reality for some people? Again, with the just ray of sunshine here, I am. I'm sorry.
Show them your pictures of your new dog.
Yeah, I'll pull some up.
On the lighter side, this is not a legislative question per se, but it's a great question. What do you see in the future for Paulette Jordan or Raul Labrador?
Well, Last week, was it Tuesday or Wednesday, Raul Labrador was at the White House with President Trump. One of our viewers actually sent me a screenshot from NBC Nightly News where he was sitting two seats away from the president as he was making remarks on the shutdown. And the meeting that Raul Labrador was at was about immigration. And it's interesting, though, that he's there right now when we still don't have a Secretary of the Interior, and he has expressed interest in that job, and his name has been really championed by a lot of conservative groups and websites like Breitbart. There are a lot of people who are really pulling for him to be Interior Secretary. How that's going to shake out, I don't know, but it's clear that he has the president's ear on at least immigration.
Were there cheeseburgers in the picture?
You know, there were not.
As far as Paulette Jordan, I think that she, by the end of her campaign, there were substantial divisions in the Democratic Party. And so that does not bode well for her as a Democratic champion in the future. On the other hand, she was a compelling candidate. She ran a statewide campaign. She's young. I would certainly expect to see her play a public role again in Idaho in the future.
Well, I don't know. She was the third highest vote getter among the statewide Democrat races, right? So, I'm not sure I see her as the standard bearer, but there, you know, you have to pay the light bill. So I don't know. I would think that former Congressman Labrador is probably going to end up in some place where he can be an influencer, I guess is what you all call him. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard the last of either of them, but whether either of them is in elected office again or running for elected office again, I don't know. But I don't think they disappear.
So a last question to kind of tie everything together, and it's an audience question written with the mission of City Club in mind. Questioner wanted to know, what do you all think is going to be the defining issue that hangs up this legislature and leads to protracted, albeit civil, debate?
School funding formula.
Corrections.
We haven't talked about it.
But there are a number of corrections-related issues and a number of things that are, even if aren't necessarily on lawmakers' radar, are certainly in the realm of discussion. We're talking about things like capacity in prisons and jails and whether that requires new facilities to be built, or things like reform on sentencing and probation and parole. Public defense standards, and that's not even getting into the current lawsuit from ACLU Idaho about how much the public should know about lethal injection drugs and the team who administers those in death penalty cases. This is a long shot, but I can see something potentially coming up that is really divisive when it comes to corrections.
I think if we're still here after mid-April, it's going to be because of the public school funding formula.
I think it's the school funding formula. That affects every community in the state, every school district in the state, every community in the state. And it's going to take a little while for everyone to go home and do their math and figure out how they're going to get more or less and then react.
We have to go home to do math?
Yeah. I have to take my shoes off to do math because I'm really bad at it. So
as an education reporter, I've waited on the end of the legislative session on Medicaid. I've waited on transportation bills. If it's one of my issues, it's my kind of legislative session. So I'll quit while I'm ahead here. They've been very generous with their insights and with their contributions to the City Club Landmark Fund. Phil Spence, Melissa Davlin, Betsy Russell, Stephanie West. Thank you all.
The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, things happen when people start talking. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Kevin Richard.